Welcome to the Sober Buddy Podcast, your boost of sober thinking and awesome life building. I'm Tara Zoe, CEO and co-founder here at Sober Buddy, and I am joined by Mary Beth O'Connor, author of the book, From Junkie to Judge, One Woman's Triumph Over Trauma and Addiction. Mary Beth has an incredible comeback story that is going to inspire you to no end, and I can't wait to dig into it. But first, remember to download and subscribe to the Sober Buddy app. Do some challenges, get some motivation, share screenshots of your sober tracker, and tell Buddy how you're feeling today. Welcome to the show, Mary Beth.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yes. And now we're going to have to explain the whole From Junkie to Judge. So tell us about, you've written this incredible book. So let's just get into your story and then we can kind of talk about the book within it. So let's talk about your, childhood, where it kind of all started.
Yes. And I do actually include this in the book because I really think it's important to show why it seemed to make sense at the time, for example, to pick up drugs at 12 years old.
For sure.
It wasn't out of nowhere. It wasn't out of the blue. So my childhood was problematic. My mother really wasn't bonded to me at all. And she just wasn't focused on me. And she could be violent at times, but the real violence, the more serious violence began when I was 9, when she married my stepfather, who was violent to her, which I witnessed a lot of. He was, verbally, emotionally, physically, and sexually violent to me. And it wasn't like an everyday thing, which at the time I sort of minimized it, like, but you just never knew. You never knew what was going to trigger it. At first, when she married him, I tried to comply with his like unexpected demands. Like he had a weird thing about I couldn't refer to my mother as she. I always had to say mom. I had been running around in New Jersey summers in bare feet my whole life, and suddenly I wasn't allowed to come barefoot in the house. And so these new rules, I tried to adjust, but over time I realized that it really wasn't about me. And no matter what I did, I could maybe reduce the frequency of events by some strategies that I developed, but I couldn't get rid of the risk. It was impossible because it was about him.
Right. And now you realize it was about him. Like, what age were you when you realized this is not about me, this is about him? Because I think that's a very aware thing to realize.
I think I realized it probably by 10 because for one thing, I could do the same thing day after day after day and suddenly it would be a problem.
Right.
Or I could not do something day after day after day, and suddenly that would be a problem. So it really, there was just no strong connection between my behavior and what happened to me.
Right.
And that's actually problematic in nuanced and multiple ways as you go through life, right? You don't really see that clear connection between my efforts or my choices or my behavior and the conclusion, the consequences that my effort will lead to X place. It seems sort of random as it was.
Yeah. And so you're having to live in this kind of fear, always something could happen state. And then at what point did you say, hey, I can cope with this with substances? Where did that leap come in?
So when I was 12, my girlfriend stole some Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine, which was a very popular introductory drug in my time. I grew up in the 70s. And we drank that. And that was just a mood lifter for me, right? I mean, I felt looser. I was giggling and having more fun. We were just laughing, saying silly things. So right away, that attracted my attention. I noticed immediately, this is a pleasant experience. This makes me feel less stressed, less anxious. And so I actually started pursuing alcohol pretty much from day one.
Right.
At 12, because it seemed to have a positive benefit.
Right. And did you think that, was it easy to get alcohol at 12 for you?
Well, it would be things like if I was going somewhere, and I always looked older. So when I was, let's say, 13, I could pass for 15 or 16. So I could go to parties with older people. And the drinking age in New Jersey was actually 18 at the time. And so once I was 15, if I did my hair up and put makeup on, I could actually get served at the bar. Or it would even be that we would steal, alcohol from our parents, or, everyone was always trying to find a way to get alcohol into parties, even if everybody there was 15 and younger.
Right.
And so it wasn't that I was using every day right away. It was that I was focused on how can I get it again? What's going to happen this weekend? How many beers can I steal from my stepfather and not have him notice? You know, it was just all of that, that hyper focus on it really from the start.
Right. And when you look back, you're talking about stealing beers from your stepfather. Was he, do you feel like looking back, you could say, oh, he was an alcoholic, or that he, maybe the randomness was coming from that kind of a behavior?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when we moved in with him, we moved in with him on a street that he had lived on for a long, long time. And he was probably, just haven't thought about this, he must have been in his early 30s at that point. Mm-hmm. And the neighbors told my mother that when he was younger, he was actually, he had some of these violent tendencies, but it wasn't at this level. But he was drafted into Vietnam and had some bad experiences. And their explanation was that when he came back, he had much less control and he was violent a lot more frequently. So I don't know exactly what the source of it was, but really at that young age, I didn't care. I cared about what he was doing.
Yeah, you're not like, let me diagnose you.
That's right.
For sure. And then, so you're kind of discovered the magic and the power of alcohol to take you to this other place. And then when did it start kind of getting to where it was starting to affect your life, like starting to really play a role in your life in a negative way?
So I moved on to other drugs pretty fast. I moved on, you know, I started smoking pot when I was, you know, barely 13. Then I was popping pills. My sophomore year of high school, I did a ton of acid, and definitely the alcohol alone, but especially the alcohol weed combination created some, you know, bad incidents. Like one time I was so high and my sister and I were riding our bike home, like 3 miles. I was so high, I couldn't lift my head up and I had to follow her wheel, you know, and then she had to make a big sudden swerve and I just ran straight into this big green garbage can. I mean, just weird, problematic behaviors, even at that age. Even at that age, other people were noticing that I used, you know, more than they did, that Mary Beth tended more toward the crazy excessive side of use. People would actually talk to me about it pretty early.
You're a 13-year-old. They're like, we think you have a problem.
Maybe you ought to take it easy, Mary Beth. You know, why don't you, you know, haven't you had enough today? Or so it was problematic pretty fast. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you progressed. So you progressed to meth. But how did that, because that's a big, you know, step over to, how did that all kind of come about?
So this is when I started meth, I was 16 and I started shooting meth at 17. So this is 1977 in Central Jersey, and meth had existed before, but this was the time where for the first time it was mass produced. And so there were biker gangs in sort of Western Pennsylvania that were making it. And there was just this, the whole town was, you know, well, the whole town, my friends, the
your circle.
Was very excited about the news that, you know, meth was going to be coming around more frequently. And it really did pick up speed around that time. Pick up speed.
Yeah. No pun intended.
So it was really the first time that it was mass produced and sort of flooded the area. Right. And so for us, we didn't really view speed as a highly addictive drug. We thought that, you know, I use the term junkie in my book because I was an IV addict and I, you know, shot it up on a regular basis. But in our mind, heroin was the problem drug, right? We didn't really view meth as that dangerous at first anyway, but it turned out to be a significant problem for me. So I snorted it the first time when I was 16, and within 6 months, I was shooting up on a regular basis.
Right, right. And how long did, I would imagine that at that point, then things start to spiral a little. And like, how did that progress?
I mean, I was really, by the time I graduated high school, I was really ill. I looked terrible. I had lost a ton of weight. My bones were, you know, sticking out. I was skipping school. Once I turned 18 in March of my senior year, they couldn't call my mother if I didn't go to class. And so I didn't. I was a really good student always. The one positive place I had always had in my life was school. But I wasn't going sometimes for like 2 or 3 weeks. And I just went to school and I'd tell them I was having family problems, which was partially true. And they would just let me make up the work. And so I was in problematic relationships. I was on a constant run. I would stay up for 3 days. I would maybe sleep a day and just go and go and go. When I graduated from high school, I hit a nerve in my hand that day when I was shooting up. And literally when they, you know how they give you the diploma with one hand and they shake the other hand. When the principal shook my hand, I almost screamed. It was so painful. So this is where I am when I'm graduating from high school at 18 years old.
And then how are you feeling emotionally at that stage? How are you feeling about yourself, about life? Because like that's what you were doing, but like what's going on in your head at that time?
You know, it's funny because at first, like, you know, it's for most of us, it seems to be a fun activity. It seems to be helpful in handling whatever situations we're in our family, but it doesn't last that way. So drugs turned on me pretty fast. And so I was really depressed and anxious. I just didn't really appreciate it. And it's funny because when I went into recovery and I talk about, I mean, the reality was I knew at least later, at least by my 20s, I knew that the trauma, and there were multiple traumas besides just my stepfather, I knew that's what really pushed me to keep using. But what I didn't really appreciate was that my drug use had become my number one problem by the time I was 18 years old.
Like, this is a bigger problem than the trauma now, right?
This is outweighing it. And the other reality was, I wasn't going to be able to heal the trauma until I got sober, right. You know? And so I was really in a place of hanging out with people I shouldn't have been with, relationships, some of which, you know how it is with drugs, some of them were true friendships, but still there's usually that problematic aspect to them. And I was just debilitated. When I got accepted to UCLA and I wanted to go, but I wanted to go when I applied, but by the time I was ready to go, I couldn't imagine being able to succeed at it because I was so strung out. I just literally could not think of a good reason to tell my family why I wasn't going. I went.
How did your family, like, was your family aware? I mean, they could see you physically. Were they aware that there was this issue going on?
You know, the last summer before I was in high school, I had this, it's New Jersey. It's hot. It's humid in the summertime. And so I couldn't really wear long sleeves to cover up my track marks because that would be obvious. Like, why is Mary Beth wearing long sleeves? But I had this nightgown that was really thin, but it had 3/4 length sleeves. That summer, my mother never saw me except when I was wearing that bathrobe. And she never noticed or she never said anything. There were definitely signs that they should have picked up on, but they just weren't really paying attention. And so I don't think that they knew, at least they didn't know how bad it was. And what they did know, I honestly believe they just thought it was more effort than it was worth to them, more effort than they were willing to invest to deal with it.
Right. So you ended up going to UCLA.
I went to UCLA and then I transferred to Berkeley. And so for those
years, you're in this active meth addiction and you're just like going to these amazing universities and like, are you getting good grades and succeeding?
So when I went to college, I actually did do better for 3.5 years with my substance use disorder. I still used, but I avoided meth most of the time and I mostly used on the weekend.
And what were you using? And what were you using in place of it?
So I was using a lot of alcohol. Mm-hmm. There were pills that were going around, these things called Lodes, which was sort of like a heroin. It was Doradin and Demerol or something. I forget. I looked it up when I did my book. It's in the book. I looked it up. So we're doing pills and occasionally Coke because, you know, I was in California and New Jersey didn't have Coke, but they had Coke here. But mostly I was using alcohol. And so it was problematic. I was doing some crazy things. Like one time I went out a 2-story window and I just had my fingers inside and my body was out and I couldn't get back in because I didn't have the upper body strength. People had to pull me in. So it was still crazy, but relatively speaking,
but manageable. Okay. So you go to UCLA, everybody out there, just so you know, you can be on this stuff and be going to UCLA and transferring to Berkeley. Okay. So you transferred to Berkeley and your degree, was your degree in law then? Or were you going for law?
No. So I was a history major in undergrad. Okay. And so When I, basically, the drug use escalated in January of my senior year. So I had had a really life-threatening multi-assailant rape when I was living in Hollywood. And then when I was at Berkeley, I moved in with a violent boyfriend. And so I just could not even hang on to the, you know, halfway functional level that I had attained for those 3.5 years. I just lost my grip. I couldn't even hang on. Yeah, I couldn't do it. And so I started shooting meth again. I started doing meth again in January of my senior year. And I used meth for another 10 years.
Wow. So you went 10 years. And what were you doing functionally during those 10 years to stay like afloat in life, in the sense of like what was your life looking like at that point?
So I say I worked my way down the corporate ladder. That's what I did. So every job was less responsibility and less money, and I held it for less time because I was using all the time and I couldn't get there. Or if I got there, I would leave sick in the afternoon or I wasn't concentrating. And so despite my Berkeley degree and actually having good grades at Berkeley, my last job was a word processing job that I could only hold on to for 9 months. And so it was really a downhill professional slide, but it was also just, you know, by 32, my body was starting to have problems. I was having a lot of physical problems at that point, and I was also just really hopeless. I was in a deep depression and I was miserable. I was living with my now husband, but he was really done with me. And so he was ready to kick me out. And I was just so depleted. I couldn't even get my resume together to even try to find another job when I got, you know, let go at the word processing job. So I was really, as we said in my day, tore up from the floor up when I went into rehab.
I feel like we should make that a meme, tore up from the floor up. So when you lost that last job, was that when you said, I'm going to go to rehab? That was like your turning point?
It was that. And that I couldn't even pull myself together to look again. And my husband, my partner at the time was ready to throw me out. So it was a combination. And I thought, all right, you know, what if I go to rehab? Let me at least try rehab. And so that's when I went in. I went in when I was 32.
And then I think this is an interesting point because a lot of people are probably expecting you to say, okay, I went to rehab and then it like saved my life and everything. But you had an interesting experience that has shaped a lot of what you're doing now. So let's talk about that, about what your experience at rehab was.
So in my mind, I'm going, you know, to a treatment facility, and I go, there was a women's program in Oakland because I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. And every day they would do a step study. You know, they would read one of the steps, one of the 12 steps, and then they would either read the big book or the NA text and have a conversation about it. And it so happened on my first day, they were doing step 3, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the God of my understanding, or I think it is, or higher power of my understanding. And so, you know, hearing this, I sort of raised my hand, like, you know, the good student that I was. And I said, well, what about me? You know, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. And they said, well, it doesn't have to be God. It can be any higher power. And I said, but I don't believe in higher power. And they were really adamant and vehement that this was the one and only way to get sober, that I had to find a higher power. I had to agree I was powerless, which I wasn't willing to do. And I had to comply with all they said, with the, you know, suggestions, but it was really framed more like an order, like you must do this or you were, they told me you're going to fail. You can't stay sober if you don't do it the 12 step way. That's all there is. There is no other option. So that was a problem because I knew I couldn't do it. And so I really had to figure out, well, what the heck am I going to do? They're telling me to do something that's impossible. So it was a whole nother layer of challenge to my recovery that I wasn't expecting.
Right. And then did you end up staying at that facility or did you leave? Because it's so hard because you get in and it's like you're finally taking this step and then it's like it feels like a barrier. So like how did you manage that? How did you handle that?
Well, I really didn't have much money. I didn't have insurance or anything. So I didn't have a lot of options. And so part of the dilemma was that I was looking back at 20 years of poor decision making, right? And so it was hard to trust my own judgment. And they told me I was being arrogant. I was running on self-will. You know, they told me a lot of negatives about my balking at doing something I didn't feel I could do that wasn't philosophically consistent with my worldview. And so it was really a challenge because part of me worried, what if they're right? You know, what if it's true? Although it seemed odd, really no atheist in the history of the world ever got sober. Like that seemed impossible, right? Like really, are you sure? Are you really sure? But they swore up and down that that was true. But it was frightening because I'm challenging the experts at a time when I don't really trust my own judgment. I don't trust my own decision-making because I have a poor track record. So it was really adding a complication that it turns out didn't need to be there. So I decided I was just going to do my best to keep my ears and my mind open and look for the ideas that I thought I could use that would be helpful to me and just ignore everything else. And so that's what I did. That's how I approached it.
And then how long were you there?
5 months.
Oh, wow. Because that was a long program.
It was a minimum 90 days when it was a long-term commitment, 90-day minimum when you went in. And then they had recommended early on that I stay longer because I really was in very bad shape on multiple levels. And I thought it was a good idea to stay longer. And so I was in for 5 months in total. Yeah.
Okay. And so, and then when that 5 months was up, how did you feel?
You know, I mean, I had done everything I could to pull the ideas. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong, 12 steps are a good fit for a lot of people. And I have, you know, no concerns about that at all. The problem was I was being told this is the only way.
Right.
And, but I read all the big book, I read all the NA text, and I looked for ideas I could use. Like the powerless step, I did not agree. I was powerless over my addiction, but I thought about it. And I thought, well, I can agree that I'm powerless to moderate, like very bad to not moderate. Okay. So we'll stick with that. And I put rehab had classes, right? So they taught us, you know, some of the science of substance use disorder and how to recognize and handle triggers. We had some, my husband came up for couples, you know, counseling. We had family dynamics classes and a little bit of therapy. So it wasn't that there was nothing there for me. It was that I had to sort of quietly do it my way. After the beginning, it was quiet. In the beginning, I complained and then it didn't do any good. So I just like quietly did one of my own way. And so when I got home, I was feeling pretty good. I mean, I had actually used twice when I was in rehab and it didn't get caught. And then I used once when I was home at 10 days. And then that was the last time that I ever used in 1994. I have 28 years of continuous sobriety at this point.
Congratulations. And I just want to talk about that for a second, about you using 10 days after you got out, but then that being your last time. You know, because a lot of people think like, oh, once I lapse, that's it. I failed. I'm going back. But did you learn something about yourself, like when that happened, that allowed you to stay sober?
I mean, I think it's inaccurate for us, and I mean the community, the recovery community, to pretend that most people walk in the rooms 100% committed to abstinence or able to have perfect abstinence in the beginning. That is not the most common scenario in my experience. I mean, for me, if I used three times in 5 months, that was pretty darn good. If I could have kept using three times in 5 months, I wouldn't have been in rehab.
like you said, you can't moderate.
But I can't moderate. So that was, you know, a vast improvement. And using that little did allow my brain to start to recuperate, did allow me to start getting some emotional control. I was paying attention in all the classes that they gave me. I was doing all of the reading. I was participating in all the, you know, the therapies and the group discussions and all of that. So I mean, I took it seriously. I took this process seriously just because I rejected the parts I couldn't do. It wasn't, you know, lackadaisical or haphazard. I made a serious effort. And when I got home that time and used, it was just, you know, I had left a little bit of drugs at the house and they were there. I didn't go get them. They were still there. I was like, oh, you know, one more time. And one time after that, I tried to get drugs. I went to my favorite dealer's house because I was upset and he wasn't home. And then I was just like, ah, forget it.
Well, I'm glad he was gone.
too much trouble to go to dealer number two, you know, so.
That's so progress in your addiction when it's too much trouble to go to dealer number two you're not going to use. That's really big progress.
Exactly. And so I think, you know, the reality is that most of us have a, you know, a imperfect start. And so, and I like to tell people, they think 28 years, like it's been all like straight and smooth. And no, I used three times in my first 5 months. And then that was the last time. And I didn't know it was the last time for a while. It wasn't that I, after that third time, thought, okay, that's it, I'm done forever. It was still a process to get to acceptance of not of the idea of abstinence, but also that I could do it. Some confidence that it was a real option for me, right? I mean, that takes a while to really absorb that, you know, I can figure this out. I will be able to stay sober if I, you know, try hard. That's not for me. And I don't think for most of us, something happens on day one when you walk in the room. So it was definitely a process. And part of it was that I did actually go out and find secular peer support groups when I got home. And that was really helpful as well.
What were the programs' names, you know, that you found?
So I like to remind the viewers that this is 1994 and there is no Google. Okay.
Yeah. How did you find these?
To the library. Okay. I went to the library to do the research. Are there other options that they just didn't tell me about? And lo and behold, there were. Even in 1994, there were multiple options that for some reason my rehab had apparently never heard of. So the first one I found was Women for Sobriety, which still, of course, exists today. And Women for Sobriety is a self-empowerment program. They focus on the power of positive thinking, releasing your past, taking control of your life. And they, in a WFS meeting, when you introduce yourself, you don't say, "I'm Mary Beth and I'm an addict." You say, "I'm Mary Beth and I'm a competent woman." Ooh, that's the introduction. I love that. In the beginning, I didn't mind the "I'm Mary Beth and I'm an addict" over and over and over. I thought I needed to sort of pound it in my brain. But by the time I got to WFS, it was about 8 months later, and I wasn't comfortable with it anymore. I felt like it wasn't really capturing the essence of who I was. It was really just about a small part and a part that I was starting to recover from. And so to say "I'm Mary Beth and I'm a competent woman" was really more consistent with where I was at the time. And I like to use that as an example about how what works for us at one point in our recovery may not work for us later. And that's okay. You know, you can adjust and change your mind, do whatever you need at this point.
I always think that that is in any kind of personal development, that is always a struggle point. Where especially if we have relied on a certain narrative about ourselves to rescue us from something, or we've really gone, especially if it's public and we've said, "This is who I am," or "This is what it is." When you find yourself shifting internally, there's a part of your pride that you kind of have to like, okay, or, you know, just like this mental shift, you have to say, it's okay to define myself differently now. It's okay to say, okay, that's not bad. Like you said, it worked for me. And now I can have something new that works for me. I'm not mad at that old thing, but the new thing is different.
Yeah. I mean, when I talk about recovery, one thing I point out is that our recovery plan should change over time, right? And what works for us should change over time. First of all, hopefully we've accomplished some of our early goals or steps toward those goals. And so our plan, what is the right next step, should be constantly, or at least regularly, changing, because we're moving forward. We're having success. We've met some of our initial goals. And so change is part of the process, as you say. It's a natural part. But I think it's okay to have a serious discussion with yourself about, is this the right move for me to make this change? What was helpful about it? What I was doing? Why do I think the new approach will be better? That's sort of part of that self-analysis that will help you make the right choices in your recovery and make the right next step. So I like things when they're intentional and the analysis is done. And then I think we can feel more comfortable that, okay, this is the right move. And I also will say, even with that, we're not going to make a perfect decision every time, right? That's still, right. We're just not.
Yeah, have the grace to say that I'm learning and I'm growing and I'm a developing human being. And you talk now in your book, you have a series of checklist questions, correct?
I do. I have a section of guidelines and checklists to help do a sort of a basic analytical process, especially for newcomers to go through and think through these different areas and some guidelines. And one of the guidelines is about change, you know, that you're what you'll need and what is helpful to you can change over time. And so I think those are core ideas in recovery.
And I love that you've included those in your book, because a lot of times we can get a philosophy or a memoir and we're super inspired by it, but then it's kind of like, okay, now how do I apply this in my life? Like, how then shall I live? And you just are kind of at a loss. I remember being so frustrated by that with books I read. I'd be like, I believe you, but I don't know what to do with it. So I love that you have actually like, here's checklist questions for you to ask yourself, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, what I really did is what LifeRank Secular Recovery today, and I'm on the board for LifeRank, what they call today a personal recovery plan. It's not what it was called then, but it's what it's called, they would call it now. And so what I really found in my memoir, I wanted to not only show what my life was like before I picked up so that you could understand why it happened, but also I include the first 3 years of my recovery in addition to those guidelines and checklists. And part of it is because I did it a less common way, and I wanted to sort of show it as an example. Here's how I approached it. Here's the techniques. I also talk a bit about my trauma recovery, which was really took longer. It was more challenging than my substance use recovery. But it doesn't mean I think that the other person should copy what I did, because they need to do what's right for them. It's really just sort of an example of the techniques and the sort of way of thinking that can help you figure out what's the right plan for me. What are my right next steps? What peer support program is right for me, if any? I mean, there's multiple ones. In addition to WFS, I'm on the board for LifeRank. I'm also on the board for She Recovers. You know, there are more options today, and they're easier to find with the internet.
Yes.
And also, guess what? You don't even have to pick just one. You can do what I did. I was going to multiple programs at the same time. I kept my NA women's meeting for quite a while, added WFS, added SOS, which basically is now LifeRank. LifeRank broke off in 95, added Rational Recovery, which basically is now SMART. And I pulled ideas from all of them, and I attended different meetings. I never ended up following one specific program. I synthesized and pulled ideas that I thought would be helpful to me and built a program that works for me as an individual. And today we might call that a hybrid program or a patchwork program. But I really caution, if you're in a program and they tell you you have to do it exclusively their way and you're not even allowed to look into the other options or attend other meetings, that to me is a red flag.
Right.
You know,
I think that's being talked about a lot more now.
Yes.
You know, I feel like just on social media and things of that sort, there's a lot of people speaking up saying that this, you know, there's not one way. Let's not, because, you know, there's a lot of warring with methods, you know, and harm reduction versus not harm reduction. There's a lot of warring there. And I have heard from people in all different kinds of methods, and they all swear by their method, you know? And so it's like that method really, for some people, AA was life-saving and it still is to this day. And some people never were able to connect with that, but they found incredible resources. Some people get sober, you know, from listening to podcasts. You know, there's just different mediums and different ways that people get find their way out of that place.
I think the problem becomes when you say that one way is the only way or better than the others, and the data doesn't support that. I think that the difficulty is when you go from my way worked for me to therefore my way will work for you, or even further, therefore my way is the only way that works. And when you take those last two steps, that's where you run into trouble. That's where you get off of accurate to actually not true.
And I think we can just extend that across life, everybody.
Yes, yes.
Let's just make that a broad statement.
Exactly right. Exactly right. I mean, I'm not telling my story so you copy me. I'm telling my story as an example of what you can do if you want to build an individualized recovery plan. And that's a very different way of looking at it, I think.
Right. And that appeals to certain personality. And I actually think that that kind of leads into the next part of this, because you're obviously very self, you know, kind of driven and self-motivated, because then you went to recovery. I mean, you didn't go to recovery till you're in your 30s, and then now you're a judge. So there's a gap here. Like, we need to cover the ground here. You're like, hey, I did meth for all these years and now I'm a judge. So how did that come about? How did that even like progress?
So, and I do like to emphasize the time frames. I went to law school when I had 6.5 years sober, you know, so I had to work my way back up that corporate ladder. My first job was a temporary part-time low-level admin job, because that's all I was ready to handle. But then I got a full-time mid-level job and then a supervisory job at a bigger company. And then at 6.5 years, I went to Berkeley Law. And then I worked at a big law firm. Then I went to work for the government doing class actions. And when I had 20 years sober, I was appointed a federal administrative law judge, which I did for 5.5 years until I took early retirement in 2020. And now I do advocacy basically around multiple paths to recovery. So for me, I like to give the history of it. Because it's not leaping, right? I didn't leap from sober to law school or sober to judge. It was really, what am I ready for professionally, as in all the other areas? Where am I today? Where do I want to go? What's the steps I can take today to get there? And I certainly, when I walked into the rooms, did not expect to ever be a judge. It was always about what's the right next job and how do I get the skills I need to land that next job? And then, okay, now I've got it. What's the right next job? And it's, you know, that progression. And when you have that, that realistic progression, that's setting the next plan, getting what you need so that you can reach that goal. You know, 20 years, there's a lot you can do in 20 years if you approach it that way, right? So that's how.
I think that's so encouraging to think about. There's a lot you can achieve in 20 years. You can basically create a new life.
Yes.
You know, like going from a totally different place to, and it takes, like you said, it's a moment by moment effort. There's not like this big leap, but that you can create. Because I think a lot of people, you get, you know, this is my life. This is where I'm at. That's it. And so at 6.5 years sober, how old were you? Do you mind if I ask?
I was 39 when I went to law school.
Yeah. So 39. So it's like, this is like saying like, hey, no, I'm going to create a completely new life. And you did. And I was curious when I was thinking about you as a judge, and I'm sure you've gotten this question before, but do you think your perspective of people who came into your courtroom was different than a lot of the other judges because of your experiences?
I mean, I definitely think judges could be much better trained about substance use disorder and also about recovery. I think, well, there are some who can be judgmental about it. For example, thinking that a person who has a substance use disorder, active or even history, can't be a truth-telling person, right? That somehow they're like inherently a liar because of their substance use disorder, which is untrue. But also sometimes they expect recovery to look different than it will look in real life. Perhaps maybe they're making a negative inference about someone's inability to be 100% abstinent from day one, that somehow that means they're not serious or they're not trying, when the reality is you can be very serious and trying very hard and still not have 100% abstinence from day one. It's not one, A does not equal B in that picture. And so I do think that judges in general could be trained better about that. Even to be honest, some of the judges at drug courts are 100% 12 steps, and they are not willing to allow people to go to alternate programs to get their slip signed or, you know, to have it count as peer support. Not all, but a number of them. We have a lot of complaints at LifeRing because people are forced to go to 12-step meetings because the drug court or the probation officer won't accept LifeRing signing off on their slip, which is unjustified. And, you know, first of all, there's multiple reasons why that's problematic, but including because the only study that ever compared peer support programs, that PAL study that you probably know of by Sarah Zemor, she found that comparing AA, LifeRing, SMART, and Women for Sobriety, basically they're all equally effective. Mm-hmm. And so what we should all be focused on is making sure people know they have options so they find the right fit. Because if right. they find the right fit, then their odds of success will increase. That should be all of our goal.
Yeah, I love that. And I loved bringing that into the conversation and that that's what your book is. I love that it's like, here's how to find your way and in your own way and kind of that self-empowerment of you can make this choice and you can succeed by doing this.
Well, you know, the other interesting thing about the self-empowerment approach is that what it really did for me, it taught me that I could trust myself to make decisions in my own life and to make plans and to guide myself forward. Remember, I was afraid in the beginning when they told me to do something I couldn't do. I was afraid to trust myself. I was afraid to challenge the authority that was telling me to do something. But over time, as I made the choices, as I made, you know, the decisions, again, not in isolation, not in a bubble, I'm listening, I'm reading, I'm, you know, absorbing the information, even casual conversations at an NA meeting, I might hear an idea that I thought was useful. I mean, it's not like I'm saying I'm going to do it myself. Like,
you're not,
you know,
rogue.
Like this.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to hear, you know, no, I was doing my best to keep my mind open, but I was deciding what of these options, what of these suggestions or ideas are going to help me. And as I made those choices and not perfectly, but mostly made good decisions, I learned to trust myself to make decisions in all the other areas of my life. So it was a real important learning process. It trained me to have more confidence in my ability to lead my life, more confidence in my competence to run my own life.
You know, what's interesting is Paul and I have had some conversations about how the process of struggle while you're getting sober is the thing that it starts to heal you. You know, that alone, that where everyone's like, oh, it's such a struggle, but that actual struggle is what heals you and builds your personal belief and like can start to heal your trauma even.
That's interesting because we do all want it to be easy, but it usually isn't going to be easy. And you're right. There is value. There's value if you're paying attention. You know, why am I struggling? You know, what's making it hard for me or what's getting in my own way? And if you're sort of doing the research, you know, like even let's say in 12 steps, people talk to each other. I'm having a hard time putting together more than a week. You know, do you have any ideas? And so it is the struggle or the lack of perfection is that, as you're saying, sort of an impetus to learn more, to think more, to grow from that. And then in the long run, you will have a stronger foundation for your sobriety. I think you're right. I think that's an interesting idea.
Yeah, I thought it was such a kind of a beautiful way to view the struggle of the comeback, you know, like that actual struggle, not just the time passed or things. It's like the actual struggle is what's kind of like building your muscles, you know, yes. back to living in a healthy way. And I've met so many people now who being able to get sober was what gave them the personal belief to achieve something amazing in their life. It was the actual ability to overcome something that was so powerful in their life.
That's true. I mean, you know, there are a few challenges in life harder than getting sober, right? And so, you know, I mean, we should be proud of our accomplishment, you know, not ashamed of our addiction, but proud that we were able to accomplish sobriety because it is a challenge and it is the foundation really for everything else. I mean, for me, I had to work on the trauma. I had PTSD and severe anxiety, and I didn't even realize it until after I got sober. And I had gone to therapy a few times while I was using, and I could never make any progress. But of course I couldn't because I had drugs in my system, and I'm not connected to my feelings or my mind or any of that. And so when I talk about how I hadn't realized my substance use disorder was my number one problem, I also had to get it under a bit of control before I could do the deep work that was necessary for me to heal my trauma. And I don't mean that you have to wait. I know when I was in rehab, they wouldn't even do an evaluation or prescribe psych meds for 90 days. And now it's really viewed as best practices to look at it together early. But still, it's going to be, I still think that getting your some time sober is going to allow you to do the deep work that you need to do to heal those other mental health or trauma challenges.
Yeah, I know that we've had some conversations about that, about how, you know, you really do have to heal your brain to a point where you can connect with self, and before you can connect with self, you know, otherwise you're confused. The way your brain is affected can confuse how you really feel, you know.
It can, for me, it even confused my sense of my own history. I mean, I didn't really appreciate, I knew the big, very dramatic events had an impact, but I didn't really appreciate how that day-to-day stress impacted me almost on a deeper level. It was interesting for me. I did individual therapy, and then I went into a group therapy with women with trauma histories. And I was really stunned by their ability to talk about what had happened and the way it impacted them, but also just a lot of new ideas about behaviors I had or fears I had that were rooted back in that trauma in ways that I had not realized,
like even several years.
Yes, I had not made the connection. I really thought it was sort of just like who I was, or, you know, some flaw of mine, and not really seeing, no, this was created by the trauma. And so if you can heal it, you can actually move past it. It's not an inherent, immovable, you know, irremediable part of Mary Beth. It's actually a trauma response that I can learn to heal.
I think that is an encouraging thing to hear, you know, that there's these things that we can heal, you know, and sometimes we need to get help for that in order to heal. But it is possible to heal. I think a lot of times when we're in the midst of those anxiety or those places where it's a loop, it feels like this is how I am. I can't heal from this. And so I think it is encouraging to hear people say that you can heal and that you can move forward, as you have done.
Yeah. I mean, in the beginning, I was pushing myself to the right next step, but I wasn't really enjoying it as much as I should because of the anxiety. Like, I was always stressed and worried about one little mistake and my world is going to explode in front of my face. And so, and even now, I mean, I haven't really struggled with my substance use disorder in 25 of those 28 years, but I still say I'm mostly recovered from the trauma, because I'm 92 to 95% better, but it's still there a little bit. I haven't been able to get rid of it all, but it's manageable. The episodes are much more rare. They're much shorter. I don't spin and spin and spin for weeks. And I enjoy most days, most of my life. But it's a common combination to have trauma history or mental health challenges and a substance use disorder. Yeah. And so we do, if you want to have, you know, if you want to live our best life, at some point we are going to have to address all of it. Or we just won't have we won't have all the joys of recovery that are available to us if we don't work on the whole picture.
Well, I love that. And I think that your book is an incredible resource for people. Just, again, another perspective, another guidebook in a sense of seeing another archetype. I think we need to look at multiple archetypes to unlock all of those little doors in our mind that we don't even know are closed off. And I think that your book, again, it's called From Junkie to Judge, One Woman's Triumph Over Trauma and Addiction. I will put the link, I'll put links in the show notes so people can easily link through for that. And again, love everything you're doing. I mean, She Recovers is an incredible foundation as well. We didn't really talk about that, but if you don't know about She Recovers, check them out too. And I'm so happy to have had you on the show today. And I'm excited to hear more from you.
Wonderful. I appreciate the fun conversation, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to your viewers today very much. Thank you so much.
It has been fabulous. And everybody out there who is struggling or just thinking about getting sober, remember, you can do this. It is possible. Take it one moment at a time. Start listening. Start joining the conversation. Just start researching a little bit about what's available. You can do this. Talk to you soon.